all of these little subtle cues that say, you don't belong, you're wrong, you don't fit here, or we don't care about you. And that's really damaging to your relationship with those users, and it just doesn't, it doesn't show them the kind of respect that I think all of us would like to show people.
Welcome to the User Defenders Podcast, where we interview successful UX designers who fight for the user in order to inspire and equip you to do the same. And now, here's your host, Jason Ogle.
Greetings, User Defenders. I'm super excited to surprise you from the normal bi-weekly delivery to bring you this very special episode today that's all about designing for real life. I had the privilege of interviewing the authors of a book Apart published, Design for Real Life, themselves, all about this profound book that every designer, content person, and stakeholder should read. This is the very first time I've broken away from the usual show format. I hope you enjoy and glean big time from the wisdom imparted from my interview with Eric Meyer and Sarah Wachter-Betcher. Sarah Wachter-Betcher is a content strategy consultant, writer, and former editor-in-chief of A List Apart. She is the author of Content Everywhere from Rosenfeld Media. She's also a frequent conference speaker and content strategy workshop facilitator. She's lived in South Philly for 3 years, but has still never had a cheesesteak. Eric Meyer has been working on the web since 1993 and is an internationally recognized expert on HTML, CSS, and web standards. He's a widely read author and the founder of Complex Spiral Consulting. He's technical lead at Rebecca's Gift, a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing healing family vacations after the death of a child. He's also the co-founder of one of my favorite web conferences, An Event Apart. His first paying gig was working the fry station at a very busy McDonald's. Welcome to User Defenders, you two. I'm super excited to have you on the show today.
Thanks.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Design for Real Life is a profound and hugely inspiring book. The more things become automated and robotic, the more evident the need to remain human becomes. This book compels us to strive to stay human, especially in our approach to how we design for other humans. It deeply challenges the long-held status quo of resistance to serving so-called edge cases in our work. It also shines a floodlight on our biases that prevent us from looking at the harmful effects our design decisions can have on others when they lack thoughtfulness, compassion, and empathy. So I want to start out by just thanking you both for writing this important book.
Well, thank you. You're welcome.
Thank you. We're really happy to have been able to write it and to get people to care about the same stuff we care about. I mean, that always feels good, right?
Absolutely. It is so important. And I can't recommend enough defenders listening that you get this book right away and devour it. So if you listen to the show, you know that I always start out with origin stories. And I'm curious, what inspired you both to write this book?
It was really that we were starting to notice these things. I noticed it through some stuff that happened with me with Facebook, and Sarah was noticing similar things with forms she'd interacted with and experiences she'd had, and we both sort of blogged right about the same time of our, you know, sort of what we'd experienced and what we were thinking about, and so. Got in touch basically to say we should do this together. You know, I've been thinking this should be a book, and we both have really important perspective and different perspective, and combining forces into, you know, team real life would be, you know, the sum would be greater than the parts.
Nice. Yeah, I imagine it must have been challenging writing this book collaboratively. How did you both pull that off?
Well, you know, that was actually something that was sort of a fear of mine going into it. When Eric and I first started talking, I was like, you know, I've never co-written anything before, and I'm an editorial person. I used to be the editor-in-chief of A List Apart, right? So I am picky, and I have a lot of opinions about writing. And so it was kind of nerve-wracking for me to be like, am I going to be a good writing partner for somebody? Because it's not the same as being the editor, right? Like, I needed to be a writing partner, collaborative. So when we jumped into it, One of the things I personally did, I was trying to set aside some of my like editor hat roles around, you know, shaping and being in charge of everything. But on the other hand, I thought it was really helpful that because I've done so much editing, I could zoom out, and I felt like that helped us as we were outlining really break apart who would be the best fit where, and then where we would trade off. Because one of the things that we realized early on about this book is that this wasn't something where it would be, you know, chapter one by Eric, chapter two by Sarah, chapter three by Eric, chapter four by Sarah. It wasn't that neat and tidy. There was a lot of places where we needed to be able to really bring our ideas together, flesh out one another's sections, jump back and forth. And so I feel like my editorial background helped me at least to see how we could do that. And then I think just acknowledging, at least on my end, acknowledging that co-writing was something of a new challenge for me, helped me go into it with good expectations and sort of a good sense of, you know, okay, we're just going to get this done.
Yeah. And I had never really co-authored anything of this scope. I'd written a couple of documents in the past with other people, but they're, you know, like articles, if at most. And so I think I had some of the same concerns, but I think it helped that Sarah and I had very similar goals and very similar approaches to writing. I felt like, you know, we wrangled over things. We had a period where we were wrangling over how many M dashes to have in the text, which I thought, I look back now and chuckle, but the way that mechanically the way we did it is we set up a Slack team that was literally the two of us, and we initially did everything in Google Docs so that we could write the chapters and see changes, you know, see where someone was writing, and you know, eventually we moved it over to Microsoft Word just for the editing portion when we were going between us and a book apart for the change tracking that became important. But when we started out, it was pretty much Google Docs. Now we would just leave comments in the Google Docs, like maybe this part should be you, or, you know, I'm going to do this part, I'm not done with it yet, or, you know, whatever. So that was how we managed it sort of logistically.
Very nice. Now you present an interesting concept in here, as we're all aware of edge cases, but you both have defined what really we call edge cases should really be stress cases. Can you help define that for our listeners who haven't read the book yet?
Sure. So when we talk about edge cases versus stress cases, what we're really talking about is just looking at the same situation through a different lens. When you call something an edge case, you are literally pushing it to the fringe, right? You're saying, this is not something I'm going to focus my attention on. This is something that's at the outskirts. And what we've realized is that oftentimes the people who exist at the outskirts, not only are they real and important and valuable simply because they're people, but also, if we focus in on their needs that are a little bit more extreme than other people's needs might be, we can actually improve things for a whole lot of people at once. So when we talk about stress cases, what we're really saying is, if you take these people who are a little bit more at the extremes, if you take somebody who's going through a crisis scenario or somebody who has an identity that is often marginalized, and you look at the world through their eyes, then you'll fix problems that might have just been a minor inconvenience for other people. So you're finding those fractures where things could really fall apart, and you're using those to frame every decision that you make.
In a sense, it's like doing high-speed crash tests in automotive engineering. Like, if you smack a car into a wall at 60 miles an hour, you might be able to improve it such that you save more lives at 30-mile-per-hour collisions, not to mention 60-mile-an-hour collisions. And, it's, you know, that's... plenty of people, you know, people drive all the time and never get into any accidents. We could say, well, you know, hitting a tree is an edge case, right? Why why would we design our car for the case of somebody slamming their car into a tree? That hardly anyone ever does that. That's an edge case. No, that's a stress case. Yeah. By doing that, you find out maybe other weaknesses that you wouldn't have discovered in the design of the automobile. And it's kind of the same here. We're saying, you know, smack this into a wall at 60 miles an hour and see what breaks.
And, you know, I feel like it's kind of similar. I mean, or one of the things that's really valuable about that analogy is that you could also say, well, nobody should be driving their car that way, or why would somebody drive their car that way, right?
Yeah.
But if you're testing a car, you don't ask that question because you know that that's something that people do, right? People do all kinds of things for all kinds of reasons that are maybe reasons that seem good at the time or reasons that are terrible, who knows? But regardless, these are people who are making choices. If those people exist, then you're going to do your best to design a car that's going to keep them safe regardless, right? Even if they've made a bad decision or even if they're doing something that isn't what the car is intended to do, your goal is to keep as many people safe as possible, period. And so I think the same should be true in our work. We should be aiming to give people the best experience possible, even if they're doing things that we didn't necessarily intend or that we think are weird. I mean, you know, it's kind of like saying, well, maybe that's not our job to decide how people should use things. It's like the Karen McGrain quote about mobile, which is, you know, you don't get to decide what device somebody uses to access your website. They do.
Yep.
They're going to decide. And I think that it's really the same thing here.
I'm glad you threw that out there. I love that quote, and it's so relevant. Speaking of crash test dummies, it's great after 50 years there's a woman crash test dummy now, right?
Yeah, finally.
Oh my gosh, that whole conversation, you know, a lot of listeners probably don't realize this, but in the past, all cars have been tested with men, and so they're actually statistically substantially less safe for smaller people. And that's a real example, a very real example of people not thinking about sort of the entire range of humans that need to be considered.
Absolutely. This book is chock full of real-world stress case examples. How did you discover all of these?
You know, what's interesting about that is that at some point I felt like we weren't discovering them so much as people kept sending them to us. It's like once you start talking about these issues, and especially if you start talking, and I think Eric would probably find this is true as well, if you start talking about a personal experience that you had and it's sort of vulnerable and open, people start coming to you, right? Because you've opened up. And so people just kept coming to us and saying, you know, I read this thing that you talked about and it really resonated with me because here's this other thing that happened to me.
Wow.
And a lot of times they were things that we would have never anticipated. We wouldn't have guessed, you know, on our own. But the other piece of that I would say is that I sort of feel like once you start seeing the world a little bit differently, you can't miss them, right? Like you see these scenarios everywhere. They just like jump out at you and they become glaring.
Yeah. At a certain point we were, it wasn't so much that we were discovering them as we were trying to figure out which ones not to include in the book. We had to decide, okay, just which ones are we going to focus on and which ones are we going to have to leave out just because we don't have room. And yeah, they're kind of everywhere. As Sarah says, once you start to look at the world sort of from that different angle, all of a sudden it's just like, oh man.
Yeah, I totally agree. And we were in the hospital recently. We had our seventh child, believe it or not, a baby girl a couple months ago. And she was in NICU for a week because she was born prematurely. And so we were in a high stress environment, not knowing if she was going to be okay. And the hospital rooms are just horribly designed. They're just terribly still after all these years. I mean, when you consider like the little remote control, it was designed when Laverne and Shirley was still on television. I mean, and the little speaker coming through and all the wires in the bed and my wife's trying to move around. Anyway, it's just that was an example of that for me, like, feeling like noticing all of the design flaws because I had so much stress in my mind. I'm like, and as a designer too, I'm cursed with wanting to make things better. But even the tray, the dinner tray that's horseshoe shaped, that's supposed to fit under that extravagant bed, which never does. It never fits under there. Anyway, totally, I understand that. The whistleblower for this movement was Facebook's Year in Review. Eric, you definitely got Facebook's attention after exposing the critical design flaws around that, so much so that they even invited you to speak to this issue in front of the entire company. What was that like?
Well, first of all, I should say it wasn't quite the entire company.
Okay.
Facebook is large enough that I don't, you know, they would have had to put me in the, you know, Candlestick Park or whatever.
Okay.
I guess it's Pac Bell Park now. But Facebook has... basically a lecture series that they do where they bring people in to talk to the design team. And after I blogged about my experience with Year in Review, we go through it in the book. People got in touch with me basically at first to say, oh my gosh, we were so sorry. This was a mistake. We're going to do better in the future. And then they came back and said, would you come speak? And so I said, sure. And it was very interesting. There, the design team is totally on board with doing better as we can see, with the 2015 year in review, which was the next year after the whole thing with Year in Review blew up with me, where we actually have this in the book as well, where we say, here's what they did in 2015 and here's how it's better. Just because, you know, from having talked to them, they designed a product in terms of Year in Review in 2014, and they designed it really well. They designed it almost perfectly to meet their envisioned, you know, use scenario. But what they hadn't done is considered how that could fail, right? That's what the book is about, is to say, okay, here's how you can think about how this might go badly. Right. But it was great to be in a room with the design team and to basically to give a short presentation, but then just to sit and talk with them basically sort of in Q&A, and for them to say, you know, how would we do this? You know, what are your thoughts about that? And for me to, in some cases, to say, you know what, I don't know either, but I'm here hopefully so that you start thinking about this. And they absolutely have. And, you know, Facebook has done, I mean, they're operating at a scale that really nobody's ever touched before, right? They have what, 1.5 billion monthly active users, which is something like a quarter or a fifth of the global adult population. So they're going to run into this stuff. You know, not only are they going to have impact, I mean, they're going to have impact at scale, but it won't always be positive. And so, you know, it was great to be there and to sort of see that they were completely on board with, yeah, we need to do better at this. We need to think about this more. It was not, definitely not a situation of, well, why should we not do that? You know, why should we think about this? Why shouldn't we think about the 90% that will have a good experience here? It was definitely at our numbers, even if it's 1% of people have a bad experience, that's millions of people. and they're very cognizant of that. And I have a lot of respect for that, because I don't know if I would have the courage to do work in that kind of, at that kind of scale. It's, you know, just with the knowledge that if I screw this up, I could potentially hurt millions upon millions of people. I don't know if I personally would have that kind of courage, but they do.
Yeah, that's, and somebody like Facebook, a company like Facebook that has such a large platform, a lot of people are going to be touched by this product in some way, whether good or bad. And I noticed that there were a small number, but in comparison to the amount of stories that you have in the book, that there's a fair amount that Facebook is involved with, just because, again, of the reach and how many people are on that platform. So I think it's been a really good thing for them, and it's great that they invited you out to touch on that and to address it. Sarah, in your moving article, Personal Histories, you touch on the dilemma of how asking certain prying questions can really open up personal wounds, particularly in forms. What's a good rule of thumb strategy we should consider when trying to obtain information from our users?
Well, I think the very first question is, do you need the information in the first place? A huge amount of forms ask for information because companies want it. And while I understand that there's a lot of, you know, business reasons at play there, you have to think really hard about whether this is something that you actually need in order to have the interaction with this user that they're wanting to have. A really good tool for that we talk about in the book is a question protocol. Carolyn Jarrett talks a lot about those. If you look her up, and she has a book with Jerry Gaffney as her co-author called Forms That Work, where they talk quite a lot about how to figure out what you should be asking in the first place. And they talk about, you know, really going through and saying, well, who uses this information and why do they need it? And what are we doing with it after we collect it? And what happens if somebody doesn't have an answer for this? all of these questions that you would go through to decide whether you need to have a field or not. And, you know, there's all kinds of scenarios where fields get added just because they've always been that way. So things like salutation, like do you need to know whether a user goes by Ms. or Miss or Mrs.? Honestly, probably not, right? Like really rarely would that mean anything. Well, we heard about this scenario where a gym in the UK had bought some pre-programmed software that was for their member check-in process. And built into that system was a huge glaring bias that this gym didn't program in. They didn't realize it was there. But it was that if somebody labeled that their salutation was doctor, they got automatically coded as male. So basically, every salutation was being used to as a proxy for gender. So Mr. equals male, Ms. equals female, et cetera. But things like doctor were obviously very problematic. And so what happened is that women doctors couldn't get into the women's changing room because their key cards wouldn't work because they were coded as male. And so those kinds of biases, I mean, that's a scenario that has obvious gender bias, right? Because as we all know, women can be doctors.
Right.
But it's not, it's both a matter of the bias of the people who are building the thing and the fact that nobody noticed this and that they were collecting data they probably didn't really need in the first place. So I think that that's like the biggest, hugest thing is to say, do we really need this? But then once you get past that, the other thing I really think a lot about is, are you asking people questions about what they want, you know, things that they want to do, or are you asking them questions of identity? When you're asking questions of identity, whether you're talking about name or gender or race or just sort of like making people categorize themselves, those are always trickier. Those are always riskier. So if you're doing that, I think you want to be extra sure that that's something that you really need to do and that that's the best way to ask for that information. The more that you ask about identity, the more times you'll run up against scenarios where people don't fit your expectations because people are so much more nuanced than form fields can typically handle. And so, you know, if you really do need to collect identity information, oftentimes the other thing is to leave more fields open-ended, multi-select, things like that. I mean, I've seen tons and tons of fields where, for example, for race and ethnicity, you can only select one. And that's so alienating for somebody who identifies as multiracial. Hmm. It makes them feel like they don't fit, right? It's like all of these little subtle cues that say you don't belong, you're wrong, you don't fit here, or we don't care about you. And that's really damaging to your relationship with those users. And it just doesn't show them the kind of respect that I think all of us would like to show people. Mm.
Yeah, I'm asking for age on my survey. Is that what's the best way to ask somebody's age?
That's a good question. I'm not sure I know the answer for precisely what the right way to ask is. I would say, though, unless it's information you actually need, I would definitely keep that optional. Okay. If you're trying to get that information just because you want to know more about your listeners, mm-hmm. I think that that's understandable. But I would definitely keep it optional. Beyond that, I think... And make sure it's clear that it's optional. Beyond that, I think a simple field where people can enter it in is great.
Awesome. That was very helpful. Thank you. We've all heard of the postmortem, where the team sits down and talks about what went wrong after the project is live. But in the book, you introduce the pre-mortem, where the team sits down before the project begins to address everything that actually could go wrong. Can you speak to that fascinating concept?
We came across this in our research and we really liked it, which is why we included it. So the idea is that, let's say that you're part of a team and you're, redesigning, an app or a website or whatever. And so what happens is the group gets together and there's one person who's leading the pre-mortem, and they put out a scenario in which basically the project has failed spectacularly in some cases. Mm. And then everyone takes a few minutes, however, you know, 5, 10 minutes, whatever feels right, to write down all the reasons they can think of why that might have happened. And then everyone compares the reasons they came up with. So an example would be, all right, the redesign has launched. It's been a month. and user sign up conversion has dropped 50%. Now write down all the reasons why that might be so. Right. Mm-hmm. And so everyone, you know, writes down. And so that if everyone, what you might discover is that everyone says, oh, the copy's really misleading. Right. Oh, okay. Well, maybe we should address the copy, or maybe, you know, nobody has similar answers. And so it's sort of all things to look at together. There's an example, that was in the literature. I don't think we included it in the book, but I'm not 100% sure where, basically, the pre-mortem was, we've launched and things are ramping up and the scripts are failing. They just like, we're not getting the data converted the way it needs to be. And, in the process of that, the development team actually said, well, actually we have a fix for that, but we didn't bring it up because we weren't sure that it would get, you know, that it would get approval in effect. And they ended up doing that. They ended up implementing that thing. So it's, the idea is it's sort of like the way the military does war games. This is a failure game, basically. It's, it's a, you know, signups have dropped, or, you know, you could even do, okay, the redesign was launched and we're now the focus of a really negative viral media story about the launch. You know, what is the subject of, you know, like what are people complaining about and why has this gone viral? And, you know, maybe nobody comes up with anything, right. But, you know, maybe people come up with something and everyone says, oh yeah, that I could see where that would be a problem. So that's the basic idea.
Yeah. It's a great concept. I think that was one of my biggest takeaways, and I have a lot actually in here, but that was one that really stood out to me and really opened my eyes a lot. And it's another reason for us as a team to come together more on projects. I think we need an excuse, right, to build projects together, all the interdisciplinary areas of a team. But I think it's another great reason to come together and communicate about every project we take on and really address that as well. So I love that. It seems like a number of stress cases documented in the book have come from clear versus clever communication. The Google's April Fool's Day joke this year was a perfect example of how this can go horribly wrong. Can you offer guidance on how to better strike the balance of clear versus clever?
Yeah, I would love to talk about that. So one of the things that I've come to really recognize and talk a lot about is that cleverness is advanced level stuff. I have seen, you know, working on content strategy, I have seen over the past several years, a lot of people get really involved in things like voice and tone work. MailChimp has done a lot of really great work talking about voice and tone. And so, and they've been sort of like a leader in some of the circles that I run in. And so what I've heard is a lot of people being like, oh, wow, yeah, we got to do that because we need to show our personality. We got to make sure people know about our personality and we're fun, we're witty, we're this quirky company. We're going to delight people with our little micro copy. And I get it. I mean, like, who doesn't want to be delighted? Except that delight is actually really hard to do. And it's very hard to do it well and consistently. And it's also very hard to do it in a way that is appropriate when you have a lot of users with a lot of different scenarios. And in fact, MailChimp, which is, you know, this organization that's known for being clever and known for doing all of this work with its personality, they've pulled back from a lot of that in the past couple of years. Their content director, Kate, she told me that they realized as they were scaling, they were getting so much bigger, that they were having so many people using their service who were maybe new to email and, you know, that wasn't this sort of little company anymore that seemed scrappy. It was this big organization. And, you know, they realized that they couldn't rely on humor as much because it was really kind of getting in the way more than it was helping. And I think that that's actually largely true for a lot of organizations, is that they jump into being clever because they think that that's the way to differentiate themselves. But if you haven't done the baseline work of figuring out how you can be clear first and foremost and make sure that clarity is always the most important thing, then it's really easy to screw it up. The other thing I would say about cleverness is it's not that you can't ever have something funny, right? But it's that you have to be really careful about what, when and where that's going to work. So, for example, anything that's around interaction, right? Anything like we've been talking about with things like forms, anything that's around a user's identity, anything where a user's bit of content and your content are going to be displayed together, like in Eric's year in review story, right? Like that was the problem. It was user-generated content mapped to Facebook's joke, mm-hmm. or making a joke on user interface copy for a form field, or anything where it's basically you don't control context that much, right? That's really risky. That's where cleverness, that's where aiming for delight can cause the most problems. Versus, you know, if you have a personality and you want to be really, you want to be more funny in, say, like a blog post promoting a new feature, or the release notes of an app update or something like that, that's probably going to be a lot safer than trying to be funny at these moments where you don't know what's going on with the person who's actually interacting with your stuff.
Yeah, it's been said, John Scalzi, the science fiction author, has a phrase which I'll clean up slightly. He says the failure mode of clever is jerk, which is to say when you're trying to be clever, that's great, but if you miss the mark, you usually end up sounding like a jerk. And that tends to be the case here. Just because if you think about it, like being clever up on stage in front of a huge audience, let's say, if you're like a stand-up comedian, you can make a joke, and it might actually be something that misses the mark for some of the people in the audience. But most of the people in the audience are going to laugh at it. And so, in the context, the people that it misses for, they can kind of go along for the ride. But on the web, like we're not in an audience. You're talking, it's a very one-on-one thing. So there isn't that sort of collective experience. And so, you know, a little bit of clever copy about, you know, oh, you know, looks like you've forgotten your password. You know, you put in your password wrong too many times. Maybe the Alzheimer's is setting in. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
In the scrum or the open design office or whatever, people might go, oh yeah, that's kind of funny. And maybe not think about the fact that someone who actually has recently gotten an Alzheimer's diagnosis and knows that that's what's coming, that's going to come off really horrible. Which I would hope that nobody would actually make that joke, but it's sort of an example of that kind of thing. I was like, hey, we're going to be clever here. It's like, yeah, if you fail. and again, like Sarah said before, you end up, you know, sort of alienating the user that you're trying to build a relationship with or have, you know, or preserve a relationship with.
Those are great examples. One-to-one, we're looking at our devices. It's generally, like you said, it's just us and a company is trying to talk to us. And so you guys make some great points as to how to get to know who that is as best as you can to speak to them in the right way. And also, Sarah, I think you mentioned the MailChimp example, which is a really great one, too, because you're right. That company, I'm a MailChimp user. I'm a big fan. They really kind of put their stake in the ground around this figurehead, this Freddy character, and he's fun and he says funny things. But for them, a company like MailChimp to have the humility to acknowledge and realize that that's just not right for everyone and to totally change the way that they were kind of branding themselves. I respect that greatly.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things they've done really well is not say, well, it's not that they don't have personality anymore. It's not that they're not fun, but that they don't lean on jokes as much. They tend to look more to design to make things lighter and feel more pleasant because design, you know, having things like bright pops of color, that's not going to be nearly as problematic in a sensitive scenario as something like a joke that comes out wrong, you know?
Yep.
So they're thinking about how do we stay true to who we are in a way that's going to work for more people more of the time. And I think that that's a really wise move that any company that wants to grow and sustain itself really needs to be thinking about. Mm.
And they're a great example to follow, and they are really doing a lot. So, yeah, appreciate them. This episode is brought to you by Universal Mind, a digital design and consulting company based in Denver, Colorado. Whether you started as a digital company or not, we're all digital now, and that's been a tough transition for many organizations. Universal Mind helps mid to enterprise-sized companies find and deliver something valuable through design thinking workshops, UX design, and development consulting, and believes in supporting user defenders to help train and inspire the next generation of designers. Learn more at universalmind.com. One of the big aha moments for me after reading the book is the importance of defining stress case personas at the start of every project. What's the best way to go about creating those?
I think to some degree that really depends on your process. So what we discovered is we discovered kind of two ways of doing personas. One is to kind of come up with, to sort of invent personas that embody the kinds of users that you want. And in that case, it's really just it's a case of, you know, saying to yourself, okay, I also need to come up with a stress case persona. I need to, you know, if I'm creating a sign up or a sign in process for an airline, maybe I have a persona of somebody who just got news that they need to like get the next flight to California. And like it's a really stressful situation, and how could this process be difficult for them? But for people who create personas by actually going out and interviewing users, mm-hmm. One way to do that is and we talk about this in the book, is to not just ask them about how they use their site, but like learn about their lives. Mm-hmm. Right? Ask them about, you know, basically to find out what's going on with them and to say, you know, that was interesting. Tell me more about that. And because in a lot of cases, Sarah particularly made this observation and that if you don't sort of create that space for people to share their lives and share, you know, sort of the context in which they use your service, they'll actually probably tend to stop just short of that. You know, they'll say, well, they might say to themselves internally, well, they just want to know how I like click around and what I click on and like what I would search for. And you're not finding out why they're doing it necessarily. And so to find those things out, that can be a way where you might discover that, okay, well, you know, some of the people who use our service are doing it under these stressful conditions, and that feeds into coming up with those sorts of stress case personas. But you know, if you don't have that, if you are trying to sort of come up with this sort of small stable of here's the middle-aged housewife and the athlete on the go and this person and that person, right? Try to put in a couple, maybe one or two of the, you know, somebody who needs to use the service right now because it's really important that they do it. And also to not make all of your personas completely idealized, right? You know, the athlete on the go, also, you know, you might include some stuff that happens in people's lives, right? They're worried about their job right now, or just those kinds of details that make them more dimensional and represent some of the stresses that we can have just in everyday life.
Yeah. And part of that, as I read in the book, is to try to be careful about how we select stock photos. Like there's so many staged, cheesy smile, just kind of stereotypical stock photos that many of us use in our personas because it's easy. It's easy to find. We have accounts maybe, but it's really not true. It's not a true representation. Like personas are supposed to be as close as possible. So I think maybe we should start using Polaroids or something. Like just use something more raw or something more real and real people as much as possible. So I was a lot of insight for me, and I loved what you said in the book. It says personas often have their own blind spots obscured by the bright light of 1,000 stock photos. That was so good. Love that.
I just saw recently where women and people of color teams that are working to try to design for them have discovered that it's actually really hard to find stock photos that speak to those sorts of people. And so they actually went out and shot their own. And that might be a thing that the team could do, is rather than, rather than, you know, spending extra, you know, tons of extra time digging through Shutterstock or Getty Images or whatever, trying to find that one picture that exactly sums up this persona. Go shoot it yourself.
Hmm. You know, there's also researchers who have a lot of expertise producing things like personas who would say, you know, maybe don't even use photos in the first place, because sometimes it's, I mean, this is, you know, this is a I don't think there's a right answer here.
Sure.
But sometimes, you know, there's a lot of usage of photos in order to make the persona seem like an actual person, which if you're using a stock photo, that's probably not working anyway. But there is an idea of having, you know, having an actual individual to imagine. On the other hand, there's also something to be said for saying, you know, the purpose of a persona isn't to get hung up on somebody's age or to get hung up on how somebody looks. The purpose of a persona is to understand sort of what is their mental model going into a situation, why are they doing what they're doing, and how can you help them achieve their goals. And so by focusing too much on sort of demographic data, that's actually weakening that side of the coin. Hmm. I think that's, I don't know that there's a right answer. I mean, I think in my experience in projects that I've worked on, there have been times where I felt like imagery with a persona was really useful, and there's been other times when what we've done is more like archetypes to really think about sort of how people tend to make decisions and what kinds of stressors they have, what kinds of challenges they have, that have really shied away from any of this, like, Kim is 42 and she lives in a medium-sized town in Iowa or whatever, where, because that wasn't helpful. That wasn't the point at all. So anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there because I do think that there's a lot of people having interesting conversations about that. I would definitely look at Indy Young, for example, because I feel like she's been writing some smart stuff about that recently.
So what do you, this is an interesting question. I think it's because it's so easy to come up with excuses, unfortunately, about not designing for stress cases, and because the timelines, the deadlines, and things like that, so the shortcut is to just design for the top whatever percent. But what do you say to the design leader or stakeholder who says, we just don't have the time nor budget to design for stress cases?
I think that there's often a misperception that incorporating stress cases into your work is going to mean that you ultimately have to do more work. It's more, oftentimes I think it's more of a lens than anything else. It's like, it's just like once you, like I said, you know, as we were going through the process of writing this book, it was like, well, once we started thinking about this, it was impossible to not see these examples out in the wild. Well, the same is true when you're doing design work, right? It's like, once you learn to think about stress cases, and once you learn to think about a wider range of people, you're simply thinking about them. You're doing the same work you always did, but you're doing it with more of this input in mind. And so oftentimes I really think that it is more of a way of thinking than it is sort of like, oh, we're going to need more budget to make this possible. Of course, there are times when you might say, have to get somebody to agree to not ask a specific form question, or you might need to get somebody to want to change an existing onboarding process or something like that. And in those scenarios, I think where you'd want to start is by really identifying the risks and the opportunity. So we talked about this a good chunk in the book with some specific examples, but when it comes to risk, you might find things like terrible press. For example, I bet you that Google didn't really want their Gmail mic drop feature to get them the kind of press that it got them for April Fools, right?
Yeah.
Like terrible negative press was probably not their aim. And for a company like Google, maybe you can say it's just a blip. For most companies, press like that would not be a blip. Press like that could sink you. And so pointing those things out, I think, is really helpful on the risk side. And then on the other side of things, it's saying like, well, you know, maybe we look at how many people are abandoning our signup process halfway through, and we say, hey, I suspect a reason people are abandoning our signup process is that we're asking them more than we really need to. I know we want that data because we want to market to them later, but if we could increase the signup completion rate by X%, that would have a bigger impact on our business than the sort of marginal return on marketing to these people later based off of their, you know, whatever information we're asking from them. So you can start having conversations that are much more around, you know, widening the audience and helping more people get through your process by eliminating things that are in their way.
Yeah, that's great. I like that perspective of looking at it more as a lens, not like a complete, we got to shift completely our process and everything. That's a really great perspective. Sylvia Xanthos on Twitter, she said that she had a question. She said it'd be awesome to hear strategies on turning around pushback to necessary changes that are discovered.
Yeah, there are a number of ways that could be done, and we cover some of them in the book. I guess it depends on why you're getting, you know, like what the pushback is exactly.
Mm. Yeah.
Because if the pushback is, you know, don't waste your time on this or you're fired, then there's really only so much you can do. But hopefully, you know, hopefully it's a better environment than that. One example that we have is actually what we call creating a spectacle, which sounds like, you know, lasers and fog machines, but is actually not. Although, you know, if you That'd think be that cool, would though. Work, then that's a possibility. But no, it's the example that we have is there was a content strategist we talked to who knew that the forms that she wanted to redesign were difficult for users. They were excluding and alienating in some cases. But they were having trouble getting the stakeholders to see it. So rather than putting together a presentation with, you know, graphs and abandonment rates and numbers and all that sort of thing, they literally just showed audio and or video and audio that they'd taken of their users, their testers trying to finish these forms. Like literally in one case, they showed video of a user who spent 30 minutes with a single page trying to get through it. And I mean, the stakeholders were so struck by this that their commitment to the redesign was cemented, like literally in that meeting.
Wow.
You know, because it was a clear and human example, right? Because if they'd presented all that in data with charts and numbers, right? Like we see charts and numbers in reports all the time, and it's easy to just sort of not think about what that means, right? It creates a distance. Whereas this was, you know, I'm watching somebody getting more and more frustrated as they try to use our site, and the quote we have from this content strategist is that it had never occurred to the stakeholders that their site could actually be unkind, right? But yeah. Suddenly they got it. Suddenly they understood, like, what the problem was, and that broke through that. So that's one way to approach it. We have others in the book as well, but it's, you know, these are the sorts of things that sometimes you have to do, is to say, look, you know, actual people are having, you know, we're making people's lives more difficult, and that's not what we're here to do. We're here to make things easier for them.
Yeah, great point. And I would argue that if you are in an environment where you have compelling evidence that there are people struggling with your product, and you present that evidence to the higher ups and they still push back, you might be in the wrong place. Is that safe to say?
I mean, I am not one to say if you don't like your job, just quit, because I know it's not that easy for some people, right? We don't all have that option to just quit and get another job. But, you know, sometimes that means, okay, maybe we take another approach and maybe we can't save this project, right? Maybe we can't fix this project. But if I myself start baking these sorts of approaches into the next project and not call it out, right? Not make a big, not say, and we're also doing it for such and so, just do it as part of what you're doing, then, you know, maybe you can improve things going forward.
Yeah. I mean, I really want people to know that, on the one hand, I think at an individual level, you can, just by doing what Eric was talking about, you really can make a difference in the work that goes out the door in your organization. But then on the other hand, it's okay, right? Like you got to go to work and do your thing and you do the best you can. And there are compromises. And I really want to make sure that, you know, people know that we get that because I think it's also really easy to feel like you have to take all of this on your own, and shifting the way that the businesses value their users, that's hard work, and that can be really exhausting work. And so, you know, if we're going to be empathetic and compassionate for real life, I think that also includes the real lives of the people who are out there doing design work and are doing the best they can. So if that's you working in one of these places where it's really difficult to make change, I feel you, and that's okay. And so, you know, I mean, I think that it's all of our responsibility, and also it's not all your job or your fault if you can't make it all happen.
Yeah, there's another great example in the book too about addressing this, and sometimes it requires bringing somebody in from outside, somebody else who's an expert and can kind of be that fresh voice. You know, the prophet has no honor in his own country. So it's like, I love what Zeldman said. He said one reason people hire consultants is so the consultants can tell the boss the same things the employees have been telling them for 5 years. The core message of the book is to make sure your design serves all your users well. However, as designers, we've been taught when we design for everyone, we design for no one. This is sort of a piggyback maybe even to the last question, but do you really believe it's possible to craft great experiences that serve all of our users equally well?
I don't know about equally well. I mean, that's the difficulty. And it's, we're not going to get it right 100% of the time. Right. But we could be doing a lot better, I think, is the main argument that Sarah and I are making in the book, is that in a lot of cases, okay, designers have been taught that when you design for everyone, you design for no one. But web design is pretty much about designing for everyone. I mean, literally Sir Tim Berners-Lee's message mm-hmm. at the Olympics, this is for everyone. That is the fundamental ethos of the web. Right. This is for everyone. And so we need to be trying harder to figure out how we can serve, you know, more people. And, you know, yeah, sure, designers are taught that about designing for everyone. But what we're not taught is to think about, you know, how could this go wrong? What are the failure modes here? You know, in the way that engineers and programmers often are, and architects, you know, Architects are trained in materials and engineering and all that sort of thing, you know, in order to make beautiful buildings. But they're also taught to make beautiful buildings that do not collapse and kill the occupants.
Right.
To bring it back to sort of that physical world. And you know, automotive engineers are taught to, you know, sculpt beautiful cars that also will keep their occupants alive as much as possible, in as many scenarios as possible. And that's not something that designers are really taught to think about. Okay, how could this completely fail? How could this fall apart? You know, under different circumstances than we're currently envisioning. And you know, it's, you're not going to get everyone exactly the same. But that's the fundamental challenge of the web. One of the things that makes it really unique is that we craft these experiences for huge audiences, hopefully, right? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, every one of those interactions is literally individual. It is one on one. It's, you know, what I designed to that one person. And so this is really hard. It's really hard. It may be fundamentally insoluble at a certain level, but we could be doing better.
Mm. And you know, the thing I would just like to draw a distinction here is about the difference between saying you should design your products for everyone and saying you should design your products so that anybody who wants to do the thing that your product does can do it. Mm. And I say that because I feel like a lot of times it's important to just figure out who your audience is. And maybe there's a top audience like, oh, you know, our product, you know, our widget does this one very specific thing. And there's a core audience that tends to fit some, you know, some commonalities that is likely to buy it, but also it should work for anybody who wants that product, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, you don't design a car that's just for redheads, probably. That's an arbitrary distinction, right? That's mm-hmm. an arbitrary bit of audience. You could market your car exclusively to redheads, I suppose, but nobody would do that. Instead, you know, they're going to look at things that are more around, well, what are people trying to do, right? What is somebody trying to do with the vehicle? And in fact, I feel like you've really seen this in cars in the past several years, where it's not just, you know, minivans targeted to moms. It's like minivans targeted more to families, people who are carrying lots of stuff and kids around. And it's sort of more showing like actions and lifestyle, right? Like, what do people need to accomplish, as opposed to purely saying we're going to target only the mothers, even though that might be a huge part of the people who are buying minivans, right, or making that purchase decision. So the same is true on the web. I mean, you can say, what do people need to do, and how do we support people who want to do that thing, and focus more exclusively on actions and what people's tasks and desires are versus identities.
That's great. And I think our job is to remove as many obstacles as possible, right, for all as many people as possible to complete those tasks.
Right.
Awesome.
Yep.
So as we begin to wrap, I just have a couple more questions. We talk a lot about empathy in our work as UX people, and it's important. But I sort of feel like, to quote Princess Bride, we keep saying that word, but I don't think it means what we think it means. Now, I'd wager that many, if not all, stress cases could be eliminated if we practice true empathy. How can we as designers truly develop and maintain genuine empathy for our users?
Go talk to them. I mean, honestly, like, right. The number one thing is if I'm sitting here and having a conversation with somebody, right, and the person I'm having a conversation with is going through a difficult time, and they're telling me about, you know, that their child is sick, or that they're going through a divorce or whatever, right, the kind of stuff that just happens in life, that's easy, relatively speaking. I mean, people are still complicated, but it's relatively easy to feel empathy for that. And to sort of to listen and to want to care about it. The further you get away from people, the harder that is. And it's particularly hard because of this whole thing we were talking about, where it's like the web is this communication medium where it's like our audiences are very large, but each person is using it in a very individual and personal way, right? Yeah. So how do you have empathy for all of these individual people that you don't know about? And I think that that the answer is being able to say, well, I'm not going to be able to individually know every user's story, but if I take the time to hear users' actual stories and get a sense of the real people out there, it's going to make me a lot more aware of what I'm doing, and it's going to make me a lot more consistent in thinking about actual humans and sort of the breadth of actual humans out there as I'm making my decisions day to day.
That's a great answer. If this was your last opportunity to proclaim this important message, what would your final heartfelt plea be to every designer listening right now? Sarah?
Oh, my final heartfelt plea. My final heartfelt plea is to say, really question your assumptions. We all make assumptions. I mean, that's normal. Everybody makes assumptions. This is something that that brains simply do, because your brain is lazy. It wants to conserve energy, right? I mean, that is a fact. Your brain wants to minimize the amount of new work it has to do. So it's going to make assumptions about things happening right now based off of things that it's seen in the past. And those assumptions sometimes serve us and sometimes don't. When we need to design things, we need to be doing a lot better than going off of that sort of like rote memory in our brain, right? Like that's what helps us do things like run away from a bear. That's not what we want to be using when it comes to making design decisions. So I would say, when you're making design decisions, your work is going to have a lot of ramifications. It's going to last a lot longer than the moment in which you made the decision. And so that is absolutely the time when you need to be slowing down and forcing yourself to think about all of the assumptions that you may have made and really subvert them. Go, well, what if I'm wrong? Or what if the opposite is true? If you haven't done that with your work, then I don't think you've really done enough to be a good designer.
Eric, your final heartfelt plea?
I think it would be to be more compassionate towards your users. Karen McGrain, again, of course, because Karen is awesome and incredibly smart. And so years ago, she made the observation that we talk a lot about empathy, but there's a level beyond empathy, which is compassion. And that's, you know, taking that empathy and putting it to use. And that's what I would my plea would be to show more compassion, which is really what we're asking for here, right? This is about showing compassion towards the trials that people have, right? And not everyone has an awesome life, and yet they're still going to be interacting with the stuff that you design and create, because so much of our lives is going, you know, is being represented online more and more, and the things that we're doing online are more and more personal, more and more intimate in a way, you know, whether it's sharing the latest news on Facebook or putting up, you know, pictures on Instagram or whatever it is, right? These are really, some of these things are really emotionally weighty and intimate. And so to have that compassion, which is what we're pushing for, because, you know, the web is, it's the most human system, I think, that we've ever built. Right. It, so much of what we are is encoded really on the web in one way or another. But maybe what it needs now is a little bit more humanity.
Wow. So to quote something from the book, it's that kind of goes along with this. And as we wrap, it's, we're going to screw up. We're going to learn from it. It's only unforgivable if we don't share what we learned. And I thank you both for sharing what you've learned so far, and I know you're going to continue to do that. As we close, why don't you both tell our audience the best way to connect and to keep up with you, Sarah?
Sure. So you can find me at sarahwb.com. That's just S-A-R-A-W-B. And then you can also find me on Twitter at Sarah_Ann_Murray. So thank you for having me, and I'm happy to answer anybody's questions.
Awesome. Eric?
Meyerweb.com, MeyerWeb.com is my website, and I'm Meyerweb on Twitter and just about everywhere else that I'm online is where people can find me. And like Sarah says, you know, happy to answer people's questions, and thank you so much for having us on, Jason. Really appreciate it.
Well, I thank you both so much. This has been an absolute pleasure and an honor to have you both here to discuss this super important and profound book for our industry. Defenders, pick it up. A Book Apart has generously donated a coupon code for the book. I'll be sure to put it in the show notes. And I just want to say, fight on, my friends.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
I'm glad that was recorded, because Sarah and Eric dropped so many value bombs in that interview. We're designing for both an audience of many and of one. The task is hard, but we owe it to other humans and ourselves as designers to do our very best to abandon our assumptions and inject compassion in the products and systems we create. Our friends at A Book Apart have generously offered an exclusive Defenders discount of 15% off Design for Real Life using coupon code REALLIFEDESIGN at checkout. The link to buy is in the show notes, and the offer will expire at the end of June. If you're enjoying the show, would you do me a huge favor and take a couple minutes to leave a rating and review on iTunes? It would help me so much just to keep going doing these episodes that I love to do, but it just will help me stay charged up for this and fighting on. And it also helps get the show in front of other defenders like you and get this valuable content in front of more listeners. So thanks in advance. There's a link in the show notes that'll take you right to that. So I just want to say thanks again for listening. I know that there's a lot out there, and I appreciate you taking your time, because your time is valuable and it means a lot that you chose to spend it with me and with my guests. So I want to thank Cesar Limas for the astonishing superhero artwork, Chris Combs for the superhuman editing, and Wyman Gentry for the compelling show music. Thanks again so much for listening, and until next time, fight on, my friends.